welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Dialect Radio. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in there in Preston. Also, hello to people in Birmingham, Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands. Our guests this week are James Bruce. He's recently returned from an epic trip on foot. He was a pedestrian walking all the way from Britain to Gaza, Jerusalem, in fact, to raise money for charity. We're also speaking to Eddie Clark. Eddie runs a street theatre group that deals with political issues, and he's going to link that with the conflict in Gaza. Featured this week by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve, as ever, reads a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. We also have another feature from the Edinburgh Fringe, courtesy of Anthea Page. Jeff Sparks is still away on his holes, but he's given us his What's On guide and the song of the week, so I'll be reading you that later on. I'm John Peters Coleman, and it's my pleasure to introduce James Bruce.
Hello.
Have you recovered from your foot weariness?
Well, yes, yeah, certainly I can say that that no longer is a problem. Although, actually, probably it was a little bit sore for a few weeks afterwards. Actually, it's true.
Yeah, so how many miles is it, roughly, from all the way from Britain? Whereabouts did you start from Britain?
I think I started from Portsmouth.
Okay.
And so then crossed 11 frontiers all the way. And apparently it's about 3,000 miles. I haven't actually looked at it exactly, but something like that.
Okay, so how many pairs of shoes did you get through in 3,000 miles?
Two great pairs of shoes, and you need good pairs. Yeah.
Okay, well, not that we like to engage in product endorsement, but what was the brand of those shoes?
Okay, they were a pair of Chinese made Salomon sort of snow boots that I'd picked up in a charity shop a few years before. I didn't know when I might find them useful, but they were great. Especially because there was a lot of snow in France and Italy, especially.
Okay.
And then a pair of just more average walking boots, but actually, and they were from a charity shop as well, but they were Caterpillar ones, I think.
Well, there you go. Just the proof goes to show, you do get really good stuff from charity shops.
And that is product endorsement, but I don't mean it to be. It shouldn't really be, because obviously that's not necessarily.
So what time of year did you set off? Did you sort of plan ahead? How much did you sort of plan ahead as to all the details?
I had an idea of the route through France, at least as far as a tunnel that goes through the Alps. But then from then on, I was just making my way across Italy according to the maps that I had, which weren't actually very good. I got lost a couple of times, managed to get lost, which is amazing, really, because as a walker with stuff on your back and stuff, you'd think you would take every possible... you'd go to any length not to get lost, really, and go out of your way, but that did happen sometimes. But not too badly, so...
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about why you were doing it. You were doing it for a charity, Mary's Meals, I understand.
That's right, yeah. Mary's Meals are a charity that was founded by cousins of mine, actually, in Scotland. And so there was a sort of, I knew about them from family ties. And they provide school meals to children in some of the world's poorest countries. They started off especially in Malawi, and they also work in Sierra Leone, I think, but certainly Liberia and Kenya, and then they've moved to places in South America, also Eastern Europe, and they've been working in Haiti for a few years, so before the earthquake as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why Jerusalem? I initially said Gaza, but you actually went to Jerusalem. Why there? Why do you want to go there?
Well, Jerusalem is the ultimate or the most famous pilgrimage destination that there is on Earth. So it was a pilgrimage that I made about this time last year that actually led to the idea of walking to Jerusalem. But I was walking to a place called Walsingham in Norfolk, which the clue there is in Mary's Meals, actually, although it's not a religious charity exactly, but it does have its origins in the church. And so Walsingham is a very old shrine to Mary, to Our Lady, as we call her. So that was the motivation for going there. And then subsequently I went to a talk given by the Patriarch of Jerusalem, and then on the way over there to London, where he was, I had the idea of sort of setting out on this medieval kind of expedition to walk to Jerusalem, the way that perhaps people did more often in those days, in the Middle Ages, perhaps.
So, I mean, what was sort of the most pleasant nation or nations, possibly, in terms of how people reacted to you?
I couldn't say that there was one that was really better than all the others. French hospitality was extraordinary, but then I found that the Italians weren't to be outdone, and all through the Balkans, not least, I mean, I'd had wonderful hospitality in Croatia and Bosnia, but also Serbia, which I think is an experience of a lot of people who walk through or travel in Serbia as well. They were really very, very kind people there. But I have to say the most extravagant hospitality I did receive in Turkey. They were absolutely extraordinary. I think they have a sort of a reputation that they feel they must live up to, but they really were wonderful. Yeah, it's true. I was almost having to fend them off because I had to walk, obviously, and I was constantly being offered tea, and then it would be something to eat, and then they'd offer me maybe somewhere to stay as well, and it was wonderful. But all the way there, I met extraordinarily generous, kind people.
Did you get any people sort of coming and join in with you for a bit, or were you sort of on your own all the time?
I was pretty much on my own all the time. Apparently, there was somebody ahead of me who was walking from France, or rather riding from France on a donkey.
Right.
Who I was hoping I might catch up with eventually. It seemed as if I was getting closer to her, but she then must have, galloped off into the distance because I didn't catch her up in the end. But I think it would be very difficult to walk with somebody else unless you've got somebody who is going to be walking at the same pace and wants to eat at the same time and wants to sleep at the same time. I think it'd be very difficult. And there'd be a lot of potential for huge rows with anyone that you went with.
Did you get a lot of press interest, particularly on it?
Actually, I was supposed to have an interview when I was in Serbia, but I think I was too slow to. Somebody phoned ahead. They had a friend who was working in local TV, and they phoned up and said, "There's this English guy who will give an interview." And then they told them that I was going to be at the hotel at a certain time, but I think they thought I was going to get there quicker than I did, and so I'm not absolutely certain if that guy had been there and then left or not. But anyway, by the time I got to the hotel where I was supposed to be going, it was later than he supposed it would take me to get there, and there was no one there. So I didn't have any, apart from that, I nearly had some media interest, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how much stuff do you take with you? I mean, obviously you don't want to take piles of stuff, but your tent, your sleeping bag, and a few days.
I didn't have a tent, actually. I just had a big old army sleeping bag, nearly as old as me. It's had a date on it, 1975.
Right.
And but I was sleeping rough most of the time. Probably 2, 3, 4 nights, and then maybe try and find an affordable place to stay, and then be sleeping rough again. But I mean, for example, one of the great things about France was that when it was really cold and there was loads of snow, there were, I think, 6 or 7 consecutive nights when I wasn't needing to sleep out, and I only paid for one of those. Whereas I think, okay, well, there was one place where I'd knocked on a door to of the local church to find somewhere to stay, but apart from that, I'd been offered places or it had been arranged for me, and it was great, absolutely wonderful. Yeah,
oh, awesome. Yeah. Okay, tell me a little bit about the press interest that you've had in Britain and how you know, you went about sort of getting money and getting sponsorship. How have you done?
Well, actually, mostly that's been through the people I know in churches, local churches, not just Catholic churches, but also the St. Stephen's in the centre. St. Mary on the Quay is my parish. And also, it happens there's a church in Cirencester where some friends of mine are there, and I went over and spoke to them, and they've raised a really surprising amount for the charity on the basis of the walk I've done as well. I think they raised about £800 or £900 just there. So that's mostly been where the money has come from, but friends and family as well. Yeah, a few people at work where I am. Yeah, so, yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about your walk across the final frontier, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you arrive in Jerusalem. What was that like? Were you pretty euphoric or just tired?
it was great. The last day was great. It was a shorter walk than I thought, and it was uphill because Jerusalem's on a hill. I suppose by the time I got there, I was reasonably tired. But and I was also, as soon as I got there, I needed to find somewhere to stay. And that was marvellous because I had a couple of telephone numbers, which somebody had given me when I was en route. And found a place in East Jerusalem, late in the evening that day, called a place called the House of Abraham, which actually I'm sure the guy who runs it, the Palestinian who's been working in the cause of peace for his whole working life, his name is Ibrahim. Oh, and in fact, I can't remember his surname now. But the truth is, the thing is, if you went to Jerusalem and you asked where is the House of Abraham, people would usually know where he is.
Okay.
And it's a great place to stay, very affordable, and a place to meet people from all over the world as well. There were some German people and Japanese and Koreans, Americans.
So what was it like when you woke up the next morning and you didn't have to put your rucksack on and walk?
Well, yeah, that was nice. Yeah, that was nice. Yeah.
What did he do?
I felt like a tourist. I was just able to be a tourist and wander around. So that was, and it's a magnificent place. I can't really imagine people being disappointed. I think I was lucky, especially also because the World Cup was on. Some people report going to Jerusalem, and it's there is tension and incidents that can take place. Sometimes stones are thrown and things. And but that was all kind of.
Brought people together?
Well, at least people's attention was on football, so they weren't really worried about their
And can people give money to you finally, they're moved by your story?
Absolutely.
How can I get in touch with sort of Mary's Meals and give to charity?
Blimey, yeah. I'm a bit... I should have had the free phone number, but although I'm not a fan, I can't pretend to be a fan of the internet, but they are at a place called www.marysmeals.org. I do know that much.
Marysmeals.org, and they can get in touch
with them
there. That's right.
You can do.
Brilliant. Yeah. Any future plans for other walks? Or are you just going to do a walk walking?
People think I'm a little bit maybe flipped completely, but I have an idea. What I would love to do is actually walk across land to Mexico with help from the Almighty. But I wouldn't work otherwise, and I'd need to have a lot of money behind me. Because it doesn't cost nothing, obviously, but that would take about 3 or 4 years at least. It would be going overland across Russia and then that way. And so,
watch this space.
James
Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, we've got a bit of Eddie Reader coming up soon, if you like the sound of that, a bit of music. But first, it's my pleasure to introduce another guest with a sort of a connection to Gaza and the last guest, Eddie Clark. Hello.
Pleased to meet you.
You're an organiser of a street theatre group.
That's correct.
And you're just sort of starting up. And the link, the connection is you're doing a lot of street theatre, or you want to, certainly about Gaza,
actually,
the West Bank and stuff like that.
Yeah. Under the heading of Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
Yeah.
And therefore we're trying to help the beleaguered people of Gaza, West Bank and, general in the Middle East.
Okay, I understand. How new is your street theatre group? Because I understand you haven't actually put yourselves a name yet as such.
We haven't yet. Let the people decide.
At the moment,
we would come under the heading of agitation propaganda, would probably be a description.
So for the uninitiated, how would a street theatre group help the beleaguered people of Gaza? How does street theatre and beleaguered people in Gaza sort of connect?
Well, in the first demo we have done is the O2 Johnny Rotten or John Lydon concert. And there we built two very large, one Johnny Rotten and one... Israeli soldier.
Yeah.
And 20 maybe protesters with boycott Israel goods, on their T-shirts, carrying the message. And the general message was to raise awareness to Johnny Rotten, if he wasn't aware of it, that's playing in, he's due to play in Tel Aviv on the 31st of this month.
Right,
and that, in a way, we were saying, Johnny, you've been a great advocate for anti-government.
And now
you seem to have gone the other way. And our objective was to raise the profile of the Palestinians, their suffering, at the same time make the actual performers that were prepared to go there, that in effect they weren't helping the Palestinians. And secondly, we wanted to engage with the public themselves. They were very supportive, funny enough, and one of them even gave tickets for our guys to go in and ask Johnny Rotten not to play there.
What's your sort of history in street theatre and drama?
Well, I have a club in Bristol called the Art Bar, and is now called Lab. And we obviously we do fund events there for this particular purpose. So basically, bringing people to play to the public is very much part of that process, you know. So street theatre, entertainment, bringing issues in all in one umbrella.
Okay,
so seemed to be an idea. So we have a bit of a track record.
And okay, and you're going to try and get more sort of benefit gigs and stuff like that going and sort of focus?
Absolutely, yeah. And we want the public to join with us because it's very much everybody's journey, this, you know. I mean, you know, Palestinians now, who tomorrow. So basically it's to have a group of people that are prepared to spend time and energy, you know, making a change. And obviously at the moment we're targeting businesses, specifically for, you know, Gaza or the West Bank, but we would extend that to other factors, like whether it was, you know, a big bank doing bad things. You know, we wouldn't limit it, you know. So basically, once we get the cast...
Okay, so Bristol is sort of famed culturally for having a bit of an anarchic creative edge to it. I mean, is that what drew you to Bristol? Because I understand you're not an original Bristolian,
No.
What drew you to Bristol?
Well, I think, you know, having the likes of Banksy, you know, knowing that, you know, they've already always had an independent spirit, you know, and basically property's a lot cheaper than London as well, you know. Yeah. So basically it's very difficult, you know, to do this in somewhere like London. So
what sort of connections do you hope to make between the people of Gaza and, you know, whatever street theatre that you may do?
The community project is quite an extensive one, though it's basically in its, you know, planning stage. It would involve actually exchanges of people, ideas. It would, you know, growing. You know, we're into permaculture anyway. Okay. So
the seed has been planted.
The seed has been planted, and you know, we hopefully it'll build from there. And,
okay. How can people sort of get in touch if they're interested in getting involved?
Well, we have edwardhill@yahoo.co.uk.
So Edward Hill and the number one, edwardhill1@yahoo.co.uk. And that's part of the Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I've got to sort of wrap things up there rather quickly. But just to recap, if you're planning to go and see Johnny Rotten in Tel Aviv, don't. Eddie Clark, thank you very much, and I hope that we hear more from
and
you
thank
in the
coming
weeks and months.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
With history in mind, let's go over now to our first feature by Tony Gosling. It's an interview with a local historian, Julian Lee Jones. Eagle-eared, I should say, listeners will have observed his name mentioned before. Julian Lee Jones is one of Bristol's most learned historians. His book, Bristol Curiosities, is one of the most entertaining takes on Bristol history. And as founder of the local Temple Local History Group, he has contributed much to our understanding of the city's past.
And we had a couple of major finds and discoveries which put us on the sort of local history map. And the outcome of that was we decided to print it. We renamed ourselves as Temple Local History Group because that's where we started off our research. And we then printed it, and we actually had one of our members who was a typesetter, did all the typesetting for us. And we were put in touch with a Tame printer and a Tame book finisher, and we ended up with the range of A5 books, because we'd already started doing a little A5 pamphlet newsletter which came out either every month or every quarter, depending how much stuff we had, and it was known as the Templar.
For people that don't know, who were the Templars and what was their connection with the Knights of St John, who were the people that built the ruined church we now see just off Victoria Street?
The Knights of St John were an older order, and they were actually set up as the Knights Hospitallers in Jerusalem to actually look after the pilgrims. Later on, a group of nine knights ostensibly set up to protect the pilgrims on the dangerous pilgrimage journey from England, UK, to Jerusalem, to the Holy Land. There's a lot of controversy because nine knights on their own would be hard-pressed to defend even one shipload of pilgrims, let alone the thousands that were making the pilgrimage. And also they were ensconced in Jerusalem for quite a long time before there were any outward activities. But nevertheless, the Knights Templar, because they had papal blessing, it was in the interest of feudal landowners to actually make donations to the Templar proteges. So if the Templars as in Bristol's case, came along and said, we would really like to build a church or an establishment in the Bristol area, because Bristol, of course, was a port, and they exported the wool coming down from the Cotswolds down through Bristol. It was in the interest of the local landowner, in this case Robert de Barclay, to give them some land, and that's how they acquired the estates in Bristol.
The excommunication and the banning of the Templars was quite controversial. What's your own thoughts on what happened there?
Well, enough to be said is the Pope has recently apologised and it was all a bad mistake. It took him quite a long time, sort of 700 years, to actually get round to apologising.
Just now you mentioned that you had a couple of major fines. Can you just tell us about those?
One of our first major fines, some of us had been involved in archaeological rescue digs in our previous existence as engineers and scientists working for Sperry. On the way to the pub in the centre of Bristol, Broad Street, lunchtime, going along the counterslip, and there was a building work going on, and being engineers and being nosy, we sort of peered over and realised all these trenches, and all around the edge of the trenches there were little bits of pots and bits of odds and ends. So, being very reticent, we went in and asked the builders what was going on. They were busy pouring concrete in some of the trenches, foundations. It was the Courage Brewery site. They explained that they were digging up loads and loads of bits of pottery. So we went and had a look, which they invited us in, and we realised that they were not just somebody's broken old dinner plates that had been thrown in a hole in the ground, but they were unglazed, which meant it was biscuit ware. Now, we'd already discovered that the site of the crescent-shaped building was built over the site of Bristol Pottery, the Pountney and Allies, Pountney and Goldney, John Decimus Pountney, whose grave is in Temple Churchyard. And it was probably a spoil tip from the pottery in the middle of the 19th century. Coincidentally, my desk was situated, as I discovered later, two stories up over the mouth of the kiln where some of this pottery was actually made. So we contacted the museum, Georgina Plowright, and they came hot-footing down and had a look and said, yes, this is Bristol pottery, definitely. Some of the patterns we don't recognise. Can your group help rescue the lot? So we spoke to the site manager and the chap in charge at Courage in Bristol, and they all agreed. And so we spent 45 man-hours over the next week frantically digging out and rescuing as much of the pottery as we could. That was May 1980. I have just handed over the last of the 25 crates of pottery sherds that we got out of there to the museum. Bristol Pottery moved from Temple back out to Fishponds, where many Bristolians will be familiar with Bristol Pottery at Fishponds Lodge Causeway. After that, the pottery eventually closed in Bristol and moved down to Cornwall, and it was taken over by a Dutch company, and all of the designs and all of the plates and everything else went to Cornwall. The Dutch company, when they decided to close it down, Royal Cordon, they had all of these copper plates, and they said, what on earth is all this stuff, the transfer printed ware? And they just took them back to Holland and melted them down for the copper, which meant there were an awful lot of designs. All of the records will have gone, either lost in the Blitz or going to the scrapyard. Sheena Stoddard and Karen Walton at the museum and Georgina pointed out that what we were digging out of the ground were hitherto unrecorded patterns, because some of it was plain white biscuit ware. In other words, just the plain household china, plates, dinner plates, what have you. And the other was transfer printed, but not the final firing, not the glaze finish. And because we had people who were illustrators and people who had done archaeology before, we were able to go through, look after this under archaeological guidance from the museum and record it all and do all the proper drawings. It's added to the Bristol's knowledge of some of these otherwise lost patterns and part of Bristol's industrial heritage.
Thank you much, Lee, to Julian Lee Jones there. He was talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about some of the Temple Local History Group's discoveries. More of that next week, and you can find out more about the group on the internet. www.history4u.info, and 4u is the number 4 and the letter u. history4u.info.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We follow on with another feature by Tony Gosling, and as ever, we're hot on current affairs here. This is about Dr. Beeching of old. Railways were at the heart of Bristol's industrial history in years gone by, but back in the early 1960s, Dr. Beeching closed most of them down and got rid of all but the most high profit margin routes. Philip Horton, a historian, has just published the first of two books on the Beeching cuts in the southwest, and our very own Tony Gosling asked him why.
My name's Philip Horton. I grew up in Bath in the 1960s, and like many lads of my age, I was very interested in railways and spent quite a lot of time train spotting, which is not cool today, but it was a very popular occupation then. And suddenly I read in magazines that this Dr. Beeching had come along and proposed closing nearly all the lines, all the branch lines that I knew, including the main Somerset and Dorset line down to Bournemouth. And I decided at the age of 16 that I would try and visit all of these lines and travel on them before they got closed. So the summer of 63, I had a Rail Rover ticket for the South West, which for £5 you could go all the way from Salisbury to Penzance or Bristol to Taunton, Bristol to Weymouth, and spent a week doing that, visiting most of the lines with my box brownie. And so that's when the story started. Coming up to the anniversary of the Beeching Report now, though I now live in Lincolnshire, well away from the West Country, but my heart has always been in this area, I decided to catalogue it in this book called The Beeching Legacy. And I started off covering the whole of the South West, but in the end we found we had too much material, and this particular volume just covers the West Country, the area west of Taunton, really down to the Lizard Peninsula. And then volume two, which we hope to produce in about a year's time, will include the rest of Somerset, Gloucestershire, Hampshire, and most of Dorset.
So what's your verdict on Dr. Beeching? Was he doing something which was absolutely necessary at the time? Or do you think he took a bit of an... Because it was called the axe, wasn't it? The Beeching axe. Yes. Did he pare off too much from our railway network?
Well, it's a very difficult subject. I think he did a job that needed doing. It was the way that he did it and the rushed way in that it was done that caused the problems. I mean, he was no doubt an excellent businessman. He looked at everything in terms of loss and profit, etc. And at the time, the railways didn't know really where they were getting their money from and where they were losing it. And he at least did set up a proper accounting system. And unfortunately, that showed that 90% of the revenue of the railways came from less than 50% of the network. And so clearly something needed to be done about that. What he wasn't any good at was public relations and giving a human touch. And he was totally unsympathetic to the idea that there was a society's need for the railway. So it didn't matter how remote the area was. If the line wasn't paying, if not enough people were using it, then it would be closed.
So could you tell us about some of the sort of pattern of closures in the west of England?
Well, it was pretty comprehensive, really, that maps were produced in the Beeching Report which showed all the lines that were making a loss. And the well, to come back a little step further, that there was a survey done in April 61 of the passengers using every line, and from that the maps were produced. Unfortunately, one of the criticisms of the report is that was done in April, while a lot of the lines, like to Ilfracombe or Padstow, Bude in Cornwall, carried all their passengers in the summer, and that wasn't taken into account. And I think a criticism of the whole report, it was done in a hurry. The government, for whatever reason, wanted a quick result. He'd been brought in at £24,000 a year, which was his salary at ICI, which seems not much today, but then was a massive salary, to really wield the axe. And that's what it was all about. So, you know, soon closure notices were pinned up, and because there had to be an inquiry before a line was closed. And in fact, Mr. Marples, the Ministry of Transport, who was very into roads, and again, that was a criticism, he was asked whether, you know, these lines could be closed at random. And he said, no, there has to be an inquiry beforehand, and then the recommendations come to me as a minister, and I decide. But what the questioner didn't ask then, unfortunately, was, well, how many closure proposals have you turned down? And in fact, the answer then would have been none. There were none that he refused to close.
With the proposed changes by Beeching, which lines did actually get closed, and did Beeching get his way?
Very much so, initially, anyway, yes. I mean, the lines, we go a little bit outside the Bristol area, but nearly all the lines in North Devon and Cornwall closed. The branch lines onto the south coast to Lyme Regis, Sidmouth, Seaton, all lost their rail services. Up near Bristol, you've got the Porter's Head branch, the Cleveland branch, and, of course, the Somerset and Dorset line itself from Bath Green Park to Bournemouth closed. The one line that he didn't get his way, and that happened later when the Labour Party came to power after Beeching and promised that they would review all the cuts. In fact, they did very little, but they did introduce in 1968 the requirement that if there was going to be social need, that could be taken into account and the line could be subsidised. And as a result of that, the line to Severn Beach survived, because the line to Severn Beach from Bristol, which still runs today, that would have been closed as well.
What about the timing of the Beeching cuts? Because I know the railways at the time in the early 60s were already in the middle of big shake-ups and modernisation. How did that actually affect what Beeching was doing? Because it was like almost like they were trying to do two things at once.
Yes, I mean, the 1955 modernisation plan, that's when steam locomotives were replaced by diesels. And while as an enthusiast that makes me sad, it was inevitable that that would happen, that they're just more powerful, more efficient. But one problem is the working practices that went with them. The fact that anyone could take a package to a goods yard, all the little stations had goods yards where you could take a package, put it on a wagon individually, and that would go off and be shunted around in a big marshalling yard. The modernisation plan didn't really take account of changing conditions and modernising working practices. They just thought in terms of modernising the rolling stock in the locomotives.
Philip Horton there, who's just published the first book to take a close look at the Beeching cuts in 1960s southwest England. Next week we'll hear which local railway line Philip would like to have saved if he'd been Dr. Beeching.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
Well, let's hear from Anthea Page now. She was recording last week at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. The festival, now in its 64th year, is the largest performing arts festival in the world, with over 2,000 international companies taking part. This interview is with an American, Mary MacDonald Hamill from New York, who's appearing in her own show, Mary and William at the Fringe.
Mary, you've come home to your roots.
That's true. But, you know, my family always said we were Irish, and that was it. And then I came to visit Scotland, and I saw my mother's face everywhere. This was like back in the 1990s. I don't think she denied it. It was that my grandfather was kind of this magnet, and his name was spelled M.C. MacDonald. But I don't know. I just decided I was Scottish because I came here. I saw my mother's face everywhere. My son's face everywhere. Was not so in Ireland. I didn't see anybody in Ireland that looked like them. I mean, I saw people with, you know, red hair and stuff. But yeah, so I put the A back in the name. My mother's like, "That's not how we spell our name." I'm like, "Well, you know, it's like, I think we must have at one point in time." So,
tell us about your theatrical life.
Moved to New York in my early 20s. I started working in summer stock and then off-Broadway and on Broadway. I worked like constantly for like 10 years, and then all of a sudden I wasn't working anymore, and I moved to Hollywood, worked out there somewhat. At a certain point, you know, life moves on, and I just created my own show just so I could work, really.
Here at the Edinburgh Fringe, what's your show called?
My show is called Mary and William. The whole title is Mary and William in Search of the Miraculous, but the only place you'll find that title is in the program. It's too long to fit anywhere else. Yeah, I'm Mary, and William is William Shakespeare. It's called that because, well, the way the show started was I wanted to understand Shakespeare better, so I started memorizing all the great speeches. Yeah, and I memorized and learned about 35 main, you know, soliloquies and speeches, and I started performing them. And the way they were, I mean, my audience had to point this out to me. The way I had lined them up, they were telling a story, and it was my it was my story. So I started filling in the spaces with different episodes from my life, which has been very, very dramatic and very poignant and very disturbing and very ambitious. Yeah, so ended up with this, had to keep cutting away the Shakespeare, cutting away, cutting away, cutting away, which was heartbreaking. But it still remains, but it's a shadow of itself. What's left is like, I mean, I can tell you that I do Hamlet, and I do Cleopatra, and I do Lear, and I do Prospero, and I do Juliet. But in the play, they're not those characters. They're Mary's voice. Mary, when Mary can't speak, or when Mary has something to say that just needs to be said, you know, in a certain way, Shakespeare says it.
So you use him to express your
feelings? Yes, I do. Exactly.
Could you just give us a little snapshot from the plays and how you've linked that to Shakespeare?
That's not a fair... I was sent away to boarding school when I was a young teenager, and it was absolutely horrendous.
Why was it horrendous?
Well, it was horrendous, first of all, because my mother had preceded me there, and my mother is this wonderful, sweet person that would never, ever do anything wrong. And I was sent away because I was just a problem child. And also my grandfather, and I talk about this in the play, had endowed the school. But even when my mother was there, she was treated badly. So then I come in, this problem child, sent away in the middle of my junior year. And so they're gonna straighten me out, okay? There was a lot of cruelty going down, and of course I didn't fit in at all. I came out of a public school system in Coral Gables, Florida. So there's a scene in the play where I am called into the Mother Superior's office, and she's holding in her hands a letter that I've written. Now, all of our mail was censored, and I had given, I don't say this in the play, but I had given this letter to one of the day girls to mail for me. Somehow, I to this day do not know how, it fell into the hands of the Mother Superior, and so I've been summoned. And there I am in the office with her, and there she is with my pale blue sheets of stationery covered on both sides with my handwriting. There's a shaft of light piercing the air between us, and I slip into it, and I slide up it to its source. A small oval stained glass window, a miniature white dove hovers there, its wings outstretched against a golden background. Shine on my contemptible estate. And in a vision full of majesty, God's mother deigned to appear to me. St. Joan from Henry VI, part 1, 2, I can't remember. More? Okay. Oh, God's mother deigned to appear to me. Her aid she promised and assured success. In complete glory she revealed herself. And whereas I was black and swart before, with those clear rays which she infused on me, that beauty am I blessed with which you see. And then I tell the letter, Dear Skeeter, I can't tell you how horrible it is here. The nuns are awful. Everybody hates me. I'm giving up talking for Lent.
So did you get punished?
Well, yeah, I think I had to scrub the floors or something. But they used to make my mother scrub the floors. I mean, it's like her father and my grandfather had, yeah, endowed the place. And it's like, I'm going to pull you down a few pegs. And I had to scrub the floor and everybody hated me. I mean, it's like I couldn't. I mean, there was no way around it. You know, I was not. But I actually ended up graduating from that school. And it was there a year and a half. At the graduation, my mother says, "You were the only person we could understand, whose voice we could hear." I don't remember what I did or what I said, but
what other trauma in your life can you relate to with Shakespeare in the play?
There's an incident that happens in childhood between my father and I. Let me see. Okay, so he's on his deathbed, and it has to be resolved.
Are you able to talk about it on air?
Well, I don't actually want to, because it's very hard for me to talk about period, and I have to do it on the stage, and somehow there's a privacy. I don't know why, it just is. But I'm on his deathbed. I say there's nuns gliding in and out, and they're strangely sweet for some reason, and the palm trees are like, through the window, they're like stretching their shadows towards the bay, which is still as ice. I mean, it's like, you know, this death is coming up at any moment, and I'm like, conscience doth make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied o'er through the with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment in this regard their currents turn awry and lose the name of action. And I slide my hand into my father's hand, and I'm not going to say it now because it's like the pinnacle of the play, what happened, but a miracle occurs. Today, there were people in the house. They couldn't leave. They were sitting in their seats crying. That was meant that it was effective. I mean, I talk about very personal things, and it's been healing for me. And the play, actually, it should be healing for anybody that has unresolved issues with their parents or things in their life or has a dream that they have not been able to follow. It's a play about that, you know. And
tell us more about the play.
The play is called Mary and William, and it's at the Gilded Balloon at Teviot Square. It's on every day except for the 16th of August. It's on through the 29th every day at 2:45.
That was Anthea Page talking to Mary MacDonald Hamill at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Time now for another instalment of Secrets and Lies, written by David Southwell. And as always, much thanks for him for letting us read this on air. Malcolm Grieve, the actor, reads another instalment this week called More Lies, More Statistics.
Secrets and Lies. Crumbs from David Southwell's table. Numbers and statistics are used by everyone from politicians to campaigners to salesmen to convince us that one solution fits all, that theirs is the only way, the only product you need. Of course, if we step back a little, we can see the main benefactor of the solution or product is the person selling it. But it's easy to be hooked in by the emotive way the numbers are presented and the importance of what they refer to. We just need to be sure to look a little closer before we fly someone else's flag. The British government is obsessed with statistics. Of course, Britain is not the only country where those in power rely heavily on bombarding the media and the public with statistical information to prove how good a job they are doing. However, in their last election campaigns, for every one statistic George W. Bush mentioned, Tony Blair mentioned four. With little ideological difference between the two major parties in Britain, statistics are used more heavily to try and differentiate how effective they have been in government. Given the importance statistics have assumed in UK politics, it is even more disturbing that they are being deliberately manipulated either by presenting them as showing something they actually do not show, or taking measures to falsify the collection of data behind them. A recent example of presentational manipulation is the last Labour government's claims that unemployment figures in the UK are better than those of its main competitors in Europe, thereby proving that their handling of the economy is better than its rivals. However, the lower unemployment figures in the UK are only achieved through the fact that 7% of the British workforce is now registered as long-term sick and therefore not counted in the jobless figures. Germany has only 2% of its workforce registered long-term sick, and France only 0.3%, which makes the then government's comparisons a total sham. Even worse is the use of techniques to falsify the data collected about the levels of homelessness in the UK. Knowing the date of the night on which the headcount survey of levels of homelessness in London was to be carried out, the government's Rough Sleeper Unit, RSU, moved sleepers off the streets for just that single night by threatening many of the homeless with arrest and also putting them in hostels that would not be able to provide a place for them again. The RSU also leaned on those who had taken the headcount to reconsider their figures, so they appeared lower. Thanks to this approach, the government could lie better through statistics, and claim that levels of homelessness had radically declined. Of course, we have a new government now. But do we have new methods of collecting statistics about their performance? Although statistics are often abused and perverted to back up the official position, stripped-down numerical facts also possess a wonderful ability to cut through a miasma of lies, half-truths and conflicting claims to reveal unpleasant truths. When that happens, it becomes very clear why governments prefer to make policy on the basis of opinion rather than evidence. After all, surely it makes sense to adopt a defence strategy based on tackling the most aggressive country in the world. It is not easy to develop a fair statistical formula for showing which nation holds the record for aggression since 1945, but two undeniable measures of aggression, bombing of another country and unprovoked military invasion of a sovereign nation, allow for a good objective assessment. Although Africa remains the bloodiest continent, with the highest number of aggressive acts occurring on it, using the above objective criteria, no single African nation emerges as a challenger for the title of the world's most aggressive country. Even given its record for invasion of satellite states such as Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968 and Afghanistan in 1979, the former Soviet Union only manages to come in a distant second to the eventual winner. The most aggressive nation is the United States of America. With 17 invasions of other countries and the bombing of 22 states since 1945, including the bombings of Korea, Cuba, Libya, Afghanistan, Vietnam and Iraq, as well as the less well-remembered bombings of Peru, Indonesia and Guatemala. It is also worth noting that the USA spends more money on its military, $276.7 billion, than the next 12 nations combined. It is a terrible irony that a country that has stood as a beacon of justice, democracy and freedom for so many in the world is revealed by statistics as the number one gangster. I do not know how a country so full of generous, open-hearted and principled people has allowed itself to earn the dubious title of the most aggressive nation in the world today, but I am certain it is a record most Americans will be appalled by. For years, various peace campaigns and anti-world poverty groups have used posters that claim the cost of ending world poverty is $450 billion, the same as is spent on arms in just 1 year. It's a neat lie to give the posters shock effect. Supporters of the idea that halting military spending could end poverty rarely check the statistical facts underpinning the claim. If they did, they would find that the truth is the sums do not add up. 8 million people around the world die each year because they are too poor to stay alive, and 1.1 billion people struggle to survive on less than $1 a day. Even using the most rigorously costed schemes to reduce world poverty provided by economists such as the UN's Jeffrey Sachs, the cost of even halving poverty is in excess of $500 billion. The figure keeps rising as populations increase and the impact of global warming and environmental changes hit. Most figures quoted do not include healthcare, as no one can agree on a definition of the minimum acceptable level. Few doubt that simply diverting funds would solve the poverty problem. Reform of land rights, access to capital and an end to developed world protectionism would also be needed. However, a realistic figure to end poverty is much closer to $1,250 billion than the figure campaigners usually quote. The truth is that there is no single magic bullet that can end world poverty, not even scrapping all military spending. However, certain statistics remain. The cost of a single B-2 stealth bomber is $1 billion. If that money was spent elsewhere, it could restore sight to 31,446,541 adults through cataract operations, remove more than 1 million landmines, create 1,150,510 clean water wells, or provide 3 months' worth of medicine for 3,030,303 communities of up to 1,000 people. Somehow, I think the shock and awe provided by any of those is worth a lot more to world peace and the spread of democracy than turning downtown Baghdad into a deadly fireworks show for the 24-hour news channels.
Well, let's find out what he's got for us next week. Malcolm Greaves, next week we'll be reading another instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Well, it's a very great pleasure, and it's always a pleasure, to introduce Trevor Carter, who's come back after a long while. How are you?
Yes, I'm fine, John.
Okay, well, yeah. Where have you been? On your holidays?
I've been to Scotland to spend some time with the laureate, Caroline Duffy. And then I've been to Wales to spend a bit of time just relaxing.
Does Wales have a poet laureate?
No, they have the English laureate imposed upon them.
Ah, they are laureateless.
As part of the union.
Okay, so have you got a bit of self?
They will have a lot of bards, of course.
Yeah, plenty
in
of
Wales.
Bards.
Yeah, it's a great tradition of oratorical finesse.
Okay, well, what have you got for us today?
Well, I'm thinking about the political situation the way it is, and unemployment going up. We're expecting, there'll be more people losing their jobs. So, being mindful of this, I think it's timely to issue advice to people who are maybe finding themselves in the position of having to sign on for the first time, even, you know. So, I'm issuing some advice to claimants. I think it's a timely thing to do. At the Ministry of Surplus Capacities, the surplus souls stand in the queues, waiting to sign on the register, to attend their ongoing reviews, to find them some more forms to fill in, and to think of what more they can do to convince us that they are willing and deserving the dosh that is due. It's not an inspiring occasion attending these temples of doom, where officials suspect there's evasion. This all fosters the feelings of gloom. So, although it's a hard life for workers, it's not that much fun on the dole, as the public like shunning the shirkers whose lives do not feature a role. It's best, if you can, not to go there, but if fate should dictate that you do, don't try to work out why life's not fair. Just smile while you wait in the queue. For we're all prone to being the victims of forces beyond our control. But don't blame yourself if this happens. Don't dig if you're thrown in a hole.
Oh, thank you very much. I think that poem should be displayed on the walls as you sort of go into the...
You think they could adopt it, really?
Yeah.
For the Department of Employment?
Yeah.
You think that maybe they should pay me just to lift the spirits, really, you know?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Probably I shall write to the Secretary of State and suggest that to him.
Excellent. And you will return to tell us the results?
I will indeed.
Do you have any events coming up at all?
Yes, I do. I'm recruiting for people to take part in the Dead Poets Slam on the 10th of September, which is part of the Bristol Poetry Festival. So anybody who is interested, just call me on 0117 966 5514.
Brilliant. And where will it be held?
It's held at the Lansdowne, as it was last year. It was very successful last year, so just recruiting people. You don't need to be a poet, I should point out. You know, you just need to, because it's a Dead Poet Slam.
Needs to be there. Yes.
Yes, you just represent your favourite ex-poet.
Brilliant.
And it's a great fun event. Free to enter. So by taking part, you get free entry to the event, and there are prizes. So, you know, it's great.
Trevor Carter,
opportunity.
Thank you.
Well,
looking distinctly un-Jeff-like, the blonde figure of Michaela Dennis.
Hello, I'm masquerading as Jeff again, John. Okay. I've done this before, but I will be presenting the What's On Guide for you this week.
Okay.
Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday the 26th of August, Goldfish Don't Bounce will be performing at the Bike Night, which is at Scally's in Carlton Street, Western Supermare. The gig starts at 8:30 and entry is free. On Friday the 27th of August, the John E. Vistick Experience will be performing as part of the Thunderfest, which is at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to our Song of the Week now, and I present Savage Garden. You may remember this duo formed in Australia in 1994 and released two albums before splitting up in 2001. This is from their second album, Affirmation, and the track is titled Two Beds and a Coffee Machine.
She takes another step. Slowly she opens the door. Check that he is sleeping. Pick up all the broken glass and furniture on the floor. Been up half the night screaming. Now it's time to get away. Pack up the kids in the car. Another bruise to try and hide, another alibi to write. Another ditch in the road, you keep moving. Another stop sign, you keep moving on. And the years go by so fast. Wonder how I ever made it. There are children to think of, babies asleep in the backseat. Wonder how they'll ever make it through this living nightmare. But the mind is an amazing thing, full of candy dreams and new toys and another cheap hotel. Two beds and a coffee machine. But there are groceries to buy, and she knows she'll have to go home. Another ditch in the road, you keep moving. Another stop sign, you keep moving on. And the years go by so fast. Wonder how I ever made it through. Another bruise to try and hide, another alibi to write, another lonely highway in the black of night. There's hope in the darkness, you know you're gonna make it. Another ditch in the road, keep moving. Another stop sign, you keep moving on. And the years go by so fast. Silent fortress built to last. Wonder how I ever made it. Ooh.
That was Savage Garden, Two Beds and a Coffee Machine from the album Affirmation. For more information, you can check them out at www.savagegarden.com. Moving now on to Saturday the 28th of August, the Cesars will be performing with DJ Rockaphonic at the Tunnels in Bristol and next to Muse, that's in Bristol. Doors open at 8 and tickets are £5 in advance. And finally, on Sunday the 29th of August, Chris Jagger's Acoustic Trio will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 and entry is free. This is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Michaela Dennis, stroke Jess Box. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guests, who were James Bruce, who walked from Britain to Jerusalem for charity. Not forgetting the charity in that case was Mary's Meals. The website for that is marysmeals.org. Thank you also to Eddie Clark, and I hope you hear more from him in the future. Features are by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and the resident person Trevor Carter. Malcolm Grieve read Secrets and Lies. Thank you very much to Jeff Sparks for the What's On, and to Michaela Dennis for reading it. The studio engineer was Lee Duffield. The producer was Anthea Page. Goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, and to you all, adieu, and see you next week. Goodbye.